published the watch review. Kind of, I guess it was like the very last day. I think it would have been acceptable to discuss, because last week I said it should be out soon. Here we are a week later, and it's up. It's just up today.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, last year we had the Series 3 watch ahead of time, and this year we for some reason, you know, we just didn't make the cut for the getting an embargo watch. So, you know, when that happens, you just take a little more time with it. And I think that also kind of informs it, like, because you can kind of also see the community reaction to, like, the watch itself. Without everyone having it, you're kind of on your own. And honestly, there are things like the infograph complications that are not there, that I might not have recognized as an early issue, because all of the ones I use are there. I kind of got lucky there.
Yeah, like doing a review that isn't time sensitive to like the product launch kind of helps relieve some of the pressure of just listing off the features as well, and actually going more into some of the finer points, like what we talk on the podcast a lot of the time, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I was glad that we got to have our discussion last week, because that was kind of like the first draft of the review in my mind, was just like talking it out with you. Cause I mean, I kind of outlined what we're going to talk about there anyway. And so once I finally got the chance to sit down and like write it, you know, and take photos for it, then, it just felt like I had no question about what I was going to write. You know, with the first watch review, so I've reviewed all four of the watches now. The first one, you know, obviously we didn't get an early watch then, and we didn't get one for Series 2, but for Series 3 we did. For the first watch, it took me like, you know, a month to kind of not just be overwhelmed by like discovering what is the Apple Watch. You know, it's a brand new thing, and it wasn't perfect either. With the second one, it was much easier to review. It was like the changes between this year and last year are like really what I'm writing about. And if you want to know about like Apple Watch as a whole thing, like read both, I guess. And then the same thing with Series 3. It was like, now I'm in a window where the watch isn't actually out yet. And I can evaluate it kind of in a bubble, you know, and it was kind of neat. And then this year it was like, the big thing was like what we talked about last week, was that the way it looks is kind of the big new feature. And the way it functions is not as important as like previous years, where like the function was the thing that changed and it looked almost the same. And I found myself in writing it, it's like so much of it was, you know, evaluating the way it looks and like how things have changed based on that. And then the part where it's like, and what does it do differently now? So much of it was like, I can't say, because I, you know, fall detection is in this category of 65 or older on by default. It's off if you're under 65, and you can't really fake it, and it won't detect every fall. And then the ECG app isn't there yet, even in beta. So there was a lot to say, certainly, but not so much about like what it does. And I even had an experience over the weekend with a family member who likes the Apple Watch, bought a Series 3 pretty recently. And she was like, what does it do different now? And I was like, on, you know, it's a real moment where you've got to, you can't just do like the marketing thing. You've got to kind of be real and be like, well, you know, this is it. And my instant response was like, mostly the way it looks, and, you know, like,
yeah,
like
functionally. And it's not just the physical design change. It's also how that impacts on the software experience.
Yeah. And whether or not you appreciate those are the changes, you're like, you know, that kind of depends on like where you fall on your interest in the Apple Watch.
And I think we kind of summarized that quite nicely last week. When,
yeah, me too.
I was kind of like bumping up the Series 3 as still a very viable option, not because the 4 is bad. Like I really like it, but the core of the appeal of that watch is still the same as the old watch. And yep. It's just more expensive. The fall detection and the ECG stuff is nice, but you have a really nice headline where it's like hidden features, and it's like these are kind of like backstops, and they're not like core things that you walk into the shop and say buy it because of this and this. It's just you run into those things as well, hopefully never, but that's yeah. That's the thing about it, isn't it? It's like hopefully you never need them, but they're there for like peace of mind and security.
Yeah, and I included a line that was kind of I feel like I needed to explain my perspective as a reviewer of the Series 4 watch, you know, and include the context of I've reviewed the original, the Series 2, the Series 3, and here's, you know, quick access to those stories. But my perspective is as someone who's upgrading every year and wearing it every day. But it's not of someone who has never had an Apple Watch, because that would be a very different story. And not even as someone who came from first gen to Series 4. And I think we'll have some, you know, some perspective in that area. But I just can't do that because that's not my experience, you know. And it was like on like a meta level, like I noticed last year, maybe the last 2 years, BuzzFeed had, I think, Nicole Wynn review the watch. And it was neat because it was like from a perspective of someone who's not like super technical, but also not like anti-technology. And it was just a pretty approachable review. And this year, it was a different person that reviewed it. I don't know their name, but it was kind of like less enthusiastic about the watch because it was coming from a perspective of like technology overload and like, does this even deserve to exist kind of thing. And so I think that perspective, like in the reviews, it is important to kind of, you know, learn what it is early on. So, you know, is this even relatable for you or not? You know, but I think at 9 to 5 Mac, we have enough people who do upgrade annually or every other year, you know, that's not wasted. And I think that there should be some perspective of that, of like, you know, you love the watch, you want to get the most out of it. What is it like this year versus last year? You know, same as we talked about with the iPhones last week.
For sure. And that kind of builds up into a thing over a period of time. Like if you are owning an original, you can see the buildup of, you know, the 3 years of changes and then make your decision based on that. Like,
yeah, exactly. And it's funny. It's like we don't review every iPhone. I mean, we could. It's just like unless we – like we did last year because we had it under embargo. But like this year, we didn't get a phone early. And Jeff Benjamin did a really good job of – making a hands-on video and story around what are, you know, the top new things that are different about this phone. And then you could, you know, look at the 10 version as like the backstory to all that. And at that point, like, you know, and our podcast discussion, I think kind of fills that in, but I don't feel like.
And Steve is really good. Photography thing where he went like on with the depth control stuff to really highlight that. Like that's to me is like, cause so many of the reviews just centered around the camera being better. And it's like, you know, what you really want to see is like out in the world, people like using that feature and those kind of things aren't reviews, but they're as informative as a big long written thing about whether the product's worthwhile to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I published a story that was pretty popular. That was the 10 camera versus the 10S and finding those differences. And yeah, and it's like, I think those stories on their own add up to what a review would be, but there's not necessarily a point of like, unless I think with the watch is different because I care a lot about it. And that isn't, I guess, the default. And also it's like my perspective every year updated. Whereas with the phone, it's like, I mean, the phone's the phone, you know, it's great, but I just don't feel the same way about it. And like you said, we have all these other individual stories that kind of make up that year's phone review. Now some things that have changed for me about the watch since we discussed last week, I've been playing a lot more with the infograph face, and, you know, part of the challenge is using all of the complication slots in a way that aren't just possible, but a way that you actually want to use them for. And I've finally struck a balance, I think, of using that face, being able to tell time easily on it, which is important. And then having information that I actually want to see there. So I found that the white version of that face is the most legible. And I really like the watch hands and the shadows and like the red second hand. And like just the colors look really neat in that way. Like even as just the clock, that face looks neat to me. And then all of the black versions are better on OLED, but not as legible for me. And I've found that I also like I get the date, my activity rings, the weather, but I also want to use those corner complications in ways that you can't out of the box. So I already had Carrot Weather, which is popular for like the snarky stuff it does, but that's not for me really. I'm not like offended by it. It's just not what I want out of a weather app. And so I've never used it, but I owned it somehow. And I downloaded it, and you can pay like $4 a year. It's $5 to buy, and like $4 a year to unlock some watch stuff on it. And you can get a corner complication for humidity. And that is one that the weather app on the watch doesn't show you, even though it does on the iPhone. And living in the South, like the air quality and the UV index are less important to me than the humidity. Like if it's the humidity is what lets me know, is it going to feel muggy outside or not? And it varies a lot. Like it often is, you know, very high in humidity. But if it's low and I see it on my watch, then I want to go outside and like take advantage of that. So I've used Carrot Weather to get that complication on the infograph corner, and it looks great. And then there's an app called Better Day that will let you add the day and date to the other, you know, a corner complication, because you can get that in the center from the calendar or date complication from Apple
on the circular ones.
Yeah, on the circular ones, but not in the corner. And so this app does it. Fantastic has an update coming out that will do it as well. But I found that app Better Day is really useful for that. I think I paid $2 for that, and I already have Fantastic Owl. It's just a matter of the update coming out. And the difference there is one will launch Fantastic Owl and one will launch Better Day. And I'd never heard of Better Day before, but apparently it's like version 5. And when you launch it, it does something amazing, which is it gives you 3 panels that you can swipe between. The central one is default, and the central one is the current year. And you see a month view for the current month, so the full October calendar. And you can spin the crown up and down to see the rest of the year, 2018. You can swipe left to see last year's full like calendar, you know, month view, scroll to see the different months in the year. And then you can swipe to the right all the way to see next year. And that on the watch, I didn't know this app existed. And I'm sure it's been that way for a long time, but I didn't know about it. But that does solves a problem for me that Apple hasn't bothered to do yet, which is show more than just the current month. Like if you're on...
Yeah, that's so dumb.
If you're on October 31st in the calendar view of Apple's calendar app, you can't see the next day, like even though it's tomorrow. You're stuck with
it's not like you just can't see the events for the next month. You can't see the next... what days those dates land on.
Yeah, like if you want to know,
scroll past
what day is November 14th on, you can't visually see that in the calendar app on the watch. It's stuck to one month, and this better
backward.
Yeah,
and if you're on the current month, it doesn't matter where you tap on the screen, it always takes you to today.
Yeah.
Like you can tap on I always want to see like next week, so you like tap on the week after and it's like, no, I'm gonna zoom in to today's day only.
Yep. So I recommend both apps, really. I mean, Fantastic Owl is a great app on its own in so many ways. And then Better Day is just like I literally bought it for this purpose of having the date in the corner because I didn't want it in the center. I wanted a clean white clock in the center and then to use all 4 corner complications for something I actually care about. And turns out it's actually a really good calendar for the watch specifically anyway. And the app interface on the iPhone is just like a virtual Apple Watch, and you can customize like – so many versions of its complications on specific watch faces. Like it visually shows you what face you're on and what you want it to look like. It's really neat.
Yeah, the calendar limitations remind me of something else that you brought up in your story, which is about the phone call situation.
Oh, yeah.
And ever since the first watch came out, you can accept calls on your wrist, you can make calls on your wrist, and you can talk through it. You've never been able to actually quit the phone app and do anything else. Like if you just get locked in the view, and if you try and press the crown, it says you cannot do this while on a call.
You got to hang up to continue. Yeah.
And the as powerful as the newer watches are, like it doesn't matter that it's 64-bit. The system still doesn't let you actually do anything else but stay in that UI. And you can go to the keypad, but you can't like look up. You know, you can't quickly check the weather while you're on the phone, or you can't check your calendar while you're talking to someone from the wrist. It just doesn't let you get out of that interface.
Yeah.
And these kind of feel like things that maybe were hardware limitations with version 1,
mm-hmm.
and then they never got lifted or they never got attention again. Similar with like the photos thing, it still has a limit of like a maximum of like 500 pictures or whatever. Like they're just random arbitrary limits that are just kind of dotted around. And I feel like now that we actually have like powerful hardware, they need to do some auditing and find those areas and, you know, just up the numbers essentially.
Yeah, maybe watch OS 6 and be that kind of an update. Like I like that part of my review there, where it's just like it's the very bottom and the just the more information section, but it's just like unrelated ideas in no specific order as bullet points, and it's just like these didn't fit anywhere else, and but I want to mention them. And the phone calls thing, I thought to test pretty late in the process, but it's like, you know, last year they should have fixed this, because you can literally make a phone call from the watch with your iPhone being like, you know, across the country, but they didn't. And this year the watch is even faster and you still can't do it. It's like, and I think that's a practical thing. Like you would want to be able to be on a phone call talking to somebody, reference a calendar event and like give them a time that you needed without hanging up or being like, oh, I'm on my watch, I can't look right now. It's kind of embarrassing.
Or even you're on like a conference call, because they're now touting you'll be able to do group FaceTime and you can join as audio from the wrist, and you just want to like see your complications and you can't leave and you're just stuck there.
Yeah, you know, check an email. Like there's a lot of things you could want to do that you can't because of limitation.
And I think it's five, like if you're on a phone call on the HomePod or on your phone, it can show that little green phone icon on the watch face.
Yeah.
Similar to Now Playing. So it's almost like they've got the UI already done for you're doing something else on the watch, but you're on the an easy way to get back to your phone call, except that you can't actually do that from the watch itself, which is really stupid.
Yeah. And another thing I like about my review that I'm happy with is just, you know, if you're curious of like, what do the watch faces look like on the new hardware? You know, I tried to have multiple examples of what Infograph can look like, what Infograph Modular can look like if you customize it a lot. And even what do all the existing watch faces look like on the new hardware? Especially something like how photos and time lapse look really good without the big bezel around the face of the watch.
Like those ones have no software changes at all, basically.
Right.
But it's just the fact the screen's bigger, so they fill more in space. And I think there was a really nice quote from Kevin Lynch back when the watch was originally introduced, and he was talking about the photos app. He was like, it's a little locket for your wrist.
Yep.
You know, where you normally just only have like one picture, but you obviously on a, you know, multi-touch screen, you can put loads of pictures and swipe between them. And the curved corners of the new design definitely evoke that locket-y feel a lot more.
Yeah, I mentioned in my review that I think the Photos app is really popular because I see people using it in the wild a
photos
lot.
Photos face.
Yeah, the Photos face.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you can do complications on it, but you can't – it's not dense. Like it's very sparse as to what you can put on there. I think it's two slots. And you don't have a lot of control over like where the time goes. It's like bottom or top of the right side. You can't pick like center or left, right, you know. But it is neat, and like, you know, you can have a different face pop up when you raise your wrist. The live photos can animate upon your wrist raise. Like it's a neat face, and having the new hardware just makes it even better. One thing I didn't do was include an example of how Infograph, like how basic it can look. And I've been tweeting these out today, but like you can make a version of Infograph that looks almost like a version of Utility. It looks almost like a version of Simple, where it's like just tick marks, you know, and no nothing else but tick marks and like varying weights and you know, amounts. I think
people kind of get go a bit over the top with the new phases are so busy. Like, yes, they are, and obviously there is a segment of people that like that. But I think you can get a really nice looking watch face if you take the Infograph analog and just turn off all the four in the middle and just only have the corner ones.
Yeah,
and obviously the clock hands, but you don't need those. They call them sub dial, by the way, in the watch app. They're called sub dial left, top, and center and stuff. Like the little circle ones.
Yeah,
like you could just turn off all the sub dial ones and only use the corners, and you have a really nice face. You could even do something even more minimal and just have the top left and bottom right diagonal of those corners. You can turn off, you know, turn off whatever you want.
Yeah, I find the weight to be weird on the wrist if you only have two top or two bottom. But if you do the diagonal, like one top left, bottom right, I think that feels pretty good.
Yeah.
So I think I'll probably do a story on this week. But, you know, to do that, by default, the Infograph face is loaded with all the complications filled up. Like, you know, if you just go and add it, or like you buy the watch is what it looks like, and then you can change them. But it takes a lot of crown scrolling to get it to be zero, like no complications, change the watch face color from what it was to what you want it to be. But I don't think it's that as discoverable as it could be. But I do think that, that's where, like, that should be an option. Start from scratch and build up. And I found that I did that a few times, and I kept ending up in the same place with the same complications and just, like, varying orders. And I was like, okay, now I know this is the way I want Infograph to loop, because I keep ending up here. And it's practical. It isn't as much as it can be. Like, I'm using zero of the center complications. And I think the text around the dial is really cool, but I just can't find one. I like the way things works, but it does limit the legibility of, like, reading the time. To me, it defeats the purpose. So I think, you know, find four good corner complications, and that's where it can get, you know, hard, because you've got to use third-party apps to do things that Apple should be able to do on their own. And that will get easier in time as more third-party apps are available for this watch face and as Apple, you know, populates more of their own. But so much of this review is about the watch faces, and I think that's, you know, this is the design year, and then, like, next year it can be about some advancement of this hardware, you know, whether it's sleep tracking or, you know, some form of always on showing the time or something. But this year, you know, the stuff that we can't see, I can't evaluate in any meaningful way yet. Just to say what we could say before, which was, it's a good thing, and we hope it helps people. A few more things I want to mention about the watch, and since using it last week, is that I'm spending more time with the older faces that have been, you know, they're on the new hardware, like time lapse. I'm using that more whenever I finish my activity rings and I've got, like, no more calendar events or tasks and things. It's just like my day is done, and I just want to, like, enjoy my, you know, wear my watch for the health tracking features, but not, like, be bombarded with information. So I'll throw on, like, the Paris face of time lapse, and it's like, you know, it's later in the day in Paris even, so it's, like, down into the evening, so it's really nice. Or London, for example, I think it's neat. Or I'll use the water version of fire and water, because you can pick fire and water together and it just cycles through both, or you can do fire alone or water alone. And I like the water alone one. I think it's really neat the way that it goes to the different, you know, kind of videos. And we saw how that was actually filmed with like a physical rig, and made into a watch face. And, like, that just makes me appreciate it even more, but I think it looks really nice. And then one idea that you and I were discussing, about something that doesn't exist yet, but that would be really neat, is kind of a new take on the Siri watch face. You know, your thinking was, what if you could do more with those Infograph modular center large complications, like the nice charts?
Like those center complications on Infograph modular are so good. Like, say what you want about Apple's lack of complications in general, but the ones they did make for that modular face are so good. Like, the activity chart is probably a better representation of your activity rings than the charts they have in the activity app itself. Like, you get nice stock quotes, you get a 5 hour by hour weather forecast. Those ones are so good, and at the moment they're kind of not wasted, but they're only available in that one place.
Yeah, you can only pick one per watch face without manually changing them. And your first thought was, like, what if you could pick five and it would change based on, like, you know, what's relevant at the moment? And I kind of took that idea and turned it into, what if it could be like the Siri watch face, where you had a whole face of, like, unlimited number of those tiles. But the difference would be, just out of preference, is that it could be in a fixed order. So the Siri watch face is, you know, you turn on the data sources, but it picks what order it's in based on things like time of day and location and that kind of thing. But what this would be is kind of like how on the dock, the apps, you can, by default, it's like recent apps based on usage, I guess. But you can also pick a sorting order, which is what I do. So it's like an app launcher. And that's what this would be like. It was like you would have the same kind of UI as a Siri watch face with scrolling through those tiles, but it would literally be those complications from the Infograph modular center in a fixed order that you decided. So you know, it would never change. You'd always see, like, the first three or so, and then you could always scroll through and see the rest of them. I think it'd be really neat.
Yeah, and it'd be a way to kind of get more features for free when people implement stuff on one face. You could also get it somewhere else, because I think at the moment, for third-party developers, the Infograph modular center still has, like, the same floor as the Siri watch face, which is you have to do quite a lot of work to get a benefit only in one place, and it's unclear how many people actually use the Siri face or even, you know, the new modular ones. Like, yeah. It's a lot of investment from both Apple and external developers for it to only be used in one place. And even if you could like refine it, even off Infocraft module itself, if you could just say, I want weather, activity, and stocks on that center complication. And it just shows one, and if you tap on it once, it just changes over to the next one and changes over to the next one, like a slideshow that you just control just by tapping. There's no intelligence, there's no like special recommendations, but you can just tap through, see them, and if you want to actually go in the app, you just like double tap. And it's just a nice way of actually being able to fit more in there than only being like limited to doubling down on just one at a single time.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you could call this new version of it Siri modular, you know, borrow from the Infograph modular name.
But it's not really intelligent, so I don't know if Siri would be a good name for it or not.
Well, you could make it be Siri, but just by having the Siri complication that's only on the Siri face as an option in this little circle corner. Yeah, yeah, that would do it. But yeah, I think that's a neat idea. And like, you know, that's not going to happen in like a point update, but you know, maybe in a watchOS 6 version or some future version. But I think that's kind of like as good of an idea as it is. I don't imagine we see this anytime soon because it.
I guess I'd say there's more exploration that could be done with watch faces in general, but specifically ones that aren't based around the time, just in the middle in this fixed spot. Like the Siri is like a scrolling list, right? I think there's more opportunity to do like timeline style interfaces on different faces.
Yeah, yeah, me too. All right, let's talk about student IDs in iOS 12 and watchOS 5 and three universities across the US.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. They announced this back at WWDC in June, and some universities have been beta testing it, but this week it became official. Apple is launching with Duke University and the University of Alabama and the University of Oklahoma. And if you're a student at one of those education institutions, you can add your student ID into the wallet app on your phone and or your watch, and you can use it as a replacement for your physical card. And I'd probably advise keeping your physical card still in your wallet or in your pocket, but it means if you wear an Apple Watch and you want to go and open the door to this building that normally requires you to scan your card, you can just scan your Apple Watch instead and just go in and go about your day. They integrate with like the gym access or lockers or even buying things, and not just buying things using normal Apple Pay, but like buying things to the and crediting your like university account, whether that's for laundry or, you know, photocopiers or the actual restaurants. And you can do it on your phone, your watch. And apparently it works really well. Like, I tweeted about it and I got a few people responding from people who'd been on the beta for this because they were doing like a trial during the summer. And everyone said it works really, really well. And I wish I could use my watch for more than just, you know, like normal Apple Pay transactions. Okay. That'd be really nice, but yeah. Sadly, no. There is one really interesting part about this is that for things like opening the door, you don't have to authenticate with biometrics to actually get in. So obviously with normal Apple Pay, you need to touch ID or face ID or enter the passcode to confirm that you actually want to make the purchase. With the student ID cards, Apple is letting it work more like passive NFC, where you can literally just hold your phone up to the reader and that'll be it. Like, you just need to be in proximity for it to unlock.
Hmm.
And you might immediately jump to the, well, isn't that really bad for like security problem? But if you think about how a dumb ID card would work, yeah, like that doesn't know who owns it or who's holding it. So if that gets lost or stolen, anyone can open the door by doing that same thing.
Yeah, a debit card always has a pen, you know, requires a signature, which is, you know, it's not super secure, you know, or a zip code at a gas pump. But a student ID is like the physical thing is the key. It's like a real key. You lose a key, it doesn't matter who's holding it either.
Yeah. And obviously, that's really, really nice feature because it doesn't mean you're slowed down every time you open the door, having to, especially on iPhone 10, where you have to like aim your face at it or double click. You don't have to do any of that. You can just hold near the reader and go. And it kind of makes me lead into like a mini feature request, which is I want this for the London Underground, which is like the UK subway system
mm-hmm.
in London. And at the moment, that just works. You can use it instead of your Easter card, which is like the equivalent like transit card thing. But it just works over normal Apple Pay, so that it treats it like a bank transaction. So you have to look at your face, then put it on the terminal, and then go. Or if you've got your watch, you have to double-click and then go. It would be really, really nice if you could just skip out the double-clicking, skip out the auth, you know, just walk up, scan, and go straight through.
Right.
Because there is a kind of, like, mini tension when you're at those when you're at the underground gates, where there's, like, a queue of, like, five people, and anything that slows you down, people start, like, giving you judging looks. When, yeah. Versus if you're doing anything non-standard, people are like, this is going to take too long. So rolling that out to London would be really, really nice. And after I spotted that they do this for the transit cards, I looked it up, and they actually do this already in some countries like Beijing and China. They call it express mode for the transit cards.
Huh.
And it means that you don't have to do authentication. You just hold near the reader and go.
I was going to ask, isn't it in Japan where they had to use like a different thing than NFC or something to have transit work on the iPhone? They have like a whole...
Yes, in Japan they use a technology called Felica, like F-E-I-L-I-C-A.
Yeah.
And on iPhone XS and iPhone XR, those can actually work in like a power reserve mode now too. That's like an extra feature where if your battery gets really low, the phone will only work. The phone will like turn itself off apart from allowing you to scan into the transit system. Like an equivalent to the how if you have really, really, if you really, really drain your battery on your watch, it just goes into that, only shows you the time mode when you click the button.
Right.
They do an equivalent like power reserve mode now on the iPhone for doing transit. Because obviously that's a real problem. Like if you rely on your iPhone only to go to the underground and your battery runs out, you get kind of stuck. Like, because obviously that you don't have that problem with a physical card that you just swipe. But if you're using an iPhone today on the underground, you can theoretically have to get an attendant or something and go down a really complicated process. If your phone happens to run out on your journey back, you'd be like essentially locked in. And so what they've started to roll out in some regions now with iPhone XS is this kind of like power reserve mode.
For the student ID stuff, do you know, so do you have to like, you know, be in the wallet app and then wave it, but not authenticate, or like, or is it like just
no, waving? You can do it. You can just hold your phone near the terminal.
That's really interesting. And on the watch, like you always, to fire up the wireless stuff, I guess, you always do the double click. Is that so? Do you know if it's all true of
that
the watch?
That is the interesting thing. You don't have to double click.
Huh.
You just hold it.
So the watch
and
is like...
this also applies to the Beijing and China express transit as well.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah. That's neat.
Because I guess because it's not payment, strictly, they can be a bit looser with the authentication they require.
Yeah, I guess originally I thought the watch was double click, like to even fire up that part of the watch. But then once the iPhone 10, like, lost, you know, iPhone lost the home button, then they did a double click there too to like prove intent. So maybe the watch always could have just been like wave it to pay, except, you know, they want to prove intent.
Yeah, because I guess on the watch there would be situations where if your arm kind of like lazily extended and the screen lit up, someone could walk past with a reader and quickly scan your watch and make you pay for something.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was like
I am ready to pay now.
Yeah, I had assumed it was like an energy saving function, but maybe it isn't like that. Maybe there's no energy to be saved really. It's just like it's firing off anyway. Just like like how, you know, on the iPhone you can always wave the iPhone near a reader and it picks it up. It's just,
yeah,
you know, you need the Touch ID or Face ID authenticate, and then with Face ID you also need to do a double click, you know, that you didn't need to do with a Touch ID.
Yeah, so the ID cards, you just wave and that's it. You don't have to do anything else.
That's nice.
You can be on the lock screen, you can be with the screen off, you just wave and you're in.
You know, I hope one day we can get to where the iPhone 10 is, and even the watch, now that I know that this is possible, where it's more like that, like you say, because, you know, with you know, Touch ID versus Face ID debate aside, it is definitely more action required to do Apple Pay on iPhone 10 with the double click of the side button to prove intent versus, like, you know, finger on the home button. Don't even turn the screen on. Just wave it near a reader, and then the screen lights up. And if your thumb's there, you know, then it knows to do it.
Hopefully, yeah, like there. The double click stuff was an extra step introduced in the last year and a bit.
Yeah,
it wasn't necessary before on the phone at all.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, I think the place where I hate the double click the most is if you're downloading a free app from the App Store.
Yeah.
Because Face ID, I mean, I'm on the iPhone XS Max now, and it's got the second, you know, a better improved version of Face ID, I guess. And I'm still often finding I'm downloading a free app on the App Store because, like, for work, you know, we test a lot of apps out, or just, like, I need an app for something. And I go and download one I've never downloaded before. So you hit the get button, not a cloud or anything. You got to hit the get button. And then you've got a Face ID and double click and line up your face right. And then it'll, you know, sometimes it'll fail. And then it wants your password. And my password from Apple ID is a complex one. So I've got to copy and paste it in. And so then it cancel out. And then I, like, start over the process. And I'm like, this is a free app. What's the worst that can happen? 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Zender, makers of the Passport Pro, the ultimate global travel adapter. 9 to 5 Mac and Zender have teamed up to give away a brand new iPhone XS Max that retails for $1099 new, and Zender is giving Happy Hour listeners special pre-order pricing on Passport Pro. This month, Zender launched Passport Pro, the ultimate global travel adapter, with one USB-C port for power delivery and three USB-A outputs. The adapter works in over 200 countries and regions and comes in a 16% smaller design than the company's original Passport travel adapter. Passport Pro is the world's first with a ground connection for added safety and a push-button resettable fuse that makes it as safe as possible for you and your devices as you travel. Sign up for the iPhone XS Max giveaway on 9to5mac.com and check out Passport Pro. Entries are open through October 17th, 2018.
I'm going to sort of blow your mind.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure what situation your Apple ID has to be in for this to work. Like whether I don't know if it works with family sharing on or not, but there is a setting conditionally, if you go into iTunes and App Store settings, require password, you can disable requiring the password for free apps. And I've definitely done this like years ago. And it definitely works sometimes, but right now it's not showing up. So I think there's some weird security thing where if it's family sharing related, maybe not, but there is, at least for some of you out there, you should be able to remove that inconvenience.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably people listening there like, this is an option. What are you talking about? You're missing it. And so that's it. But I think we're both looking at this and mine isn't there. Like where it should
same.
Be. Yeah. And there's another option. I'm looking on my iPad where it says Touch ID and passcode, I think. And it has a section for like always require. And it's the only option. It's just checked immediately and that's it.
So. Yeah, because if you turn Touch ID off, it will give you require password after 10 minutes or whatever. For that, that's always been like that since, and Face ID is the same there. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure you can have, I'm pretty sure I had a Touch ID phone and I had require password for free apps disabled. Yeah. So I'm not sure why it's not showing up now. There must be some weird thing there. But yeah, for at least some subsection of you can fix that particular issue.
Yeah, in the meantime, I'll be aligning my face with my phone at the right angle to download a free app on my phone with no harm. So, yeah. Anything else to mention on the student ID stuff?
They've announced that it'll be coming to three additional universities by the end of the school year. That's John Hopkins, Santa Clara, and Temple. But I think end of the school year can mean any time between like now and June.
So. Yeah.
It's cool that it's in three. Like that's a bigger launch than I expected by this time, actually.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be one of those things like GymKit where it'd take like a year and a half for anything to even happen.
Yeah, well, GymKit
is... So a decent launch, and I hope they bring the kind of no authentication functionality to more applications.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just sounds like anything you can actually... you can literally do with your student ID card, you can do here. And I remember losing my student ID card and having to go and like pay, you know, a fee to have it replaced and, you know, take a new photo and all that stuff. And this would be nice. Like, just keep that the physical one in a safe place. Use your iPhone. Use your watch. Impress, I guess. You know, it's cool, neat to have. So cool. And that's what I think is like, I don't know. Is there an Android equivalent of that? You know, maybe. But,
I couldn't tell you. Maybe. Yeah. There probably is because NFC on Android has been more open. So third-party developers could like stand in and do that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Also, this week we got iOS 12.1 watchOS 5.1, tvOS 12.1, and macOS 10.14.1 beta 2 versions of each of those. The big new thing is that the second beta version of each of those includes the 70 new emoji, except on Apple TV. I don't think they have emoji on Apple TV. But if you want to see those emoji on your iPhone, iPad, Mac, or Apple Watch, then you need this beta version. There's a developer and public beta version. And this includes emoji like redheaded people, bald people, bagels, some superheroes. So, you know, this is like an annual thing now where Apple preview some emoji over the summer. It's not actually in like the 0.0 release. It's in like the 0.1 release, which has some benefits. But it's like I just remember last year it was around this time of year, and we had the same preview in a beta version of the new emoji for that year. And so yeah, new emoji. But there's some other stuff in here too. Like we don't have the ECG app in the Apple Watch yet, even in WatchOS 5.1 Beta 2. But we do expect that will be there. I mean, that's kind of what the website says, right? Whenever it's out. But there's some other stuff in here too, right? Like what's going on with these betas?
Yeah, so obviously you've got group FaceTime coming back. We think they could still pull it out at the last moment. They haven't said either way yet, but it's in there at the moment. You've obviously got depth control live in the camera, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And then some smaller tweaks to stuff. The charge gate situation, which was a pretty bad bug, actually, where if your screen was off, sometimes your iPhone wouldn't charge when you plugged it in. You would have to wait the screen for that to work. Pretty bad bug. It was originally thought to be just affecting iPhone XS, although it seems like it could show up on many other iPhones and iPads of different models, maybe more popular on the XS, but definitely not exclusive to it. 12.1 includes a fix for that. I do think it's a bit strange if that fix doesn't, because 12.1 might not come out until like the very end of this month.
Yeah.
So I think it's a bit weird we haven't had a 12.0.1 yet, because we've had like a watch bug fix release, but there doesn't seem to be a phone one for some reason. And this is kind of I think this is a significant enough thing that they should protest this forward. Maybe they know better than I do on the number of devices it affects, but it certainly seems like a big problem. The beauty gate stuff, where people have been complaining that the iPhone applies too much smoothing. The iPhone still applies too much smoothing, but now people have decided that the smoothing is not just limited to skin, it applies to everything. But if you think stuff's too smooth, then nothing's changed as far as we can tell in 12.1, so keep on holding out for some sort of setting there, maybe. Like
you sent me a collection of three photos today, just asking which one I thought looked better, and I said the first one, and then I said that I think that it was ranked in order of the first one's the best, the second one's the second best, and the third one is like the least best. And then you told me what phones they were shot on, and it was 10s, 10, and Pixel 2. So
I didn't necessarily agree with your judgment there. But
right, which
I
is funny.
It's interesting that you picked the XS like immediately.
Yeah, it was literally a blind test. So I wasn't like favoring the newest phone that I have and like deprioritizing the Google phone. I just picked the one. I didn't know what the test was. It was just like you said, pick your favorite. And then I went ahead and ordered them too. And then you told me. And I felt good about that because you never know. Like, are you you know, presenting bias when you think that the phone that you have looks better than the one that you just replaced or the competitor's phone. And it's hard to say, but like in a blind test like that, I was very, and then you disagree with the order of what we looked at. But
yeah, and I think the XS camera is like great in many, many situations. I think the skin smoothing thing I do see quite a lot is like not, I think I said this on last week's show, right? I think the XS does too much noise reduction and over smoothing and probably should retain slightly more detail and like contrast contours and stuff. The other kind of minor change that I noticed in 12.1, which I think is kind of interesting, is the lock screen buttons. So like the torch and the flashlight, which are 3D touchable on iPhone 10 and later, they now have a little sound. It kind of goes like, does a little clack when you click them in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming this might be for the haptic touch affordances for the iPhone XR, just so that those users get a bit more feedback of when they're actually activating this stuff. But it is like really subtle anyway. It's just a little like click.
Yeah, and it only occurs if your phone's unmuted, which mine never is. And it's different in that haptic feedback is like always, you know, because you don't hear it. It's just you feel it. So it's subtle, but I didn't notice until you'd mentioned it. That's neat. I will say the change in 12.1, where on the XS and XS Max, you can adjust the depth as you take the portrait mode photo. You see a control for it, and you can change it. I found that really useful. And even the ability in the XS and XS Max to change it after the fact, which is already in 12.0, I think I've recovered some photos that were – like you can always take the portrait mode photo and just have the 2X version, you know, without any blur applied. But on the XS and XS Max, you can slide the blur amount left and right and have greater or less. And I've found that sometimes having much less blur saves the photo, or adding more can improve it in certain situations. But I found that to be very neat, and it's something that I wasn't quite sure I would value, because I wasn't quite sure that portrait mode was even good enough in so many instances. But I found that it really does save a lot of photos, so it's a nice thing to have. Do you know if because I know when you edited it, from my experience so far, it's always in 4.5 as like the f-stop or whatever. Is that what it is always, and then now you can change that, or is it intelligent about what it applies?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah, because if it always applies like what would be artificially like 4.5 f-stop, I guess then that's interesting, because like picking one depth for that, like for every situation, isn't intentional. Like, wouldn't be ideal. And if it's not intelligently like using the background to figure it out, you know, like are you always, if you're always doing the same amount of blur, like in the middle, then that isn't great.
I'm pretty sure on the iPhone 10 that it always had the same blur factor.
Yeah.
Because I could identify by eye what an iPhone 10 blur looked like, not by looking at the edges, just by looking at how the blur affected the background.
Yeah.
And I don't think there was any variation there. Maybe on the XS it's a bit smarter though, and they like actually do some kind of dynamic focus adjustment stuff.
Yeah, every time I hit the f-stop button now, though, like it's always in 4.5. And if I go to edit a photo after the fact, it's always in 4.5 as well. And so I don't know. But, I mean, you can apply way more blur now, or you can apply way less blur. And even if you go to the bottom amount of blur, which can really save a picture sometimes, then you can turn off portrait entirely, you know, in editing. And then it's even less, like then it's no blur. But
yeah, you can turn off portrait today though.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is that the least amount of blur isn't zero, you know, like if it says f/16, then it's not that it's like zero blur, it's still more than if you had portrait off. So there's
just subtler.
Which is like, to me, that makes me think, I feel like I'm saving pictures while still having the effect active, because it isn't like turning it to zero, it's still a little bit more than zero, which can add a cool effect. So there's some updates. My guess is that these updates will come out like around, you know, what we think will be an October event.
I'm assuming that 12.1 is what ships on the iPhone XR, so that kind of gives a timeline for it.
Yeah, which is the 26th, right, is when it hits stores, October 26th. And then probably on some new iPads. We'll get those to look forward to. The other thing I want to mention this week is Dolby Atmos. We mentioned last week that tvOS 12 is out. One of the big features of tvOS 12 is that it supports Dolby Atmos audio. Dolby Vision? Is that what it's called? Dolby Vision?
Yeah.
That's the visual side, the video side, where you know, it's a version of the HDR effect on your TV. Now you have Dolby Atmos for the audio side, and what that is like... It incorporates, like they call it immersive audio, I guess, but it's, you can have sounds come from the ceiling mounted speakers or on a sound bar fire upward instead of just out at you, and so they bounce off your ceiling and it sounds like you've got sounds coming above you, which can be above you in front, above you behind, that kind of thing. So the good thing here is that Apple upgraded a lot of iTunes purchases for free to work with Dolby Atmos without you going to need to like buy a new version, just like they did with 4K and Dolby Vision. The funny thing here is, like, obviously you need a Dolby Atmos receiver or soundbar or speaker system to work with this feature. I've got a soundbar. It's an LG SJ9. It's got upward firing speakers that bounce sound off the ceiling to have the effect, not as strong as if you had actual dedicated speakers on the ceiling with an Atmos receiver, but it's more than just like stereo, and it's neat. I've watched some movies that use this, and this is where it gets complicated. On Facebook, I'm in a Dolby Atmos group that I just like see what people think about all this stuff. And it's not specific to Apple TV. It's like all of Dolby Atmos, you know, film. And people criticize heavily Disney movies, including the Marvel movies, as supporting Dolby Atmos, but not having a, you know, like on paper, but not actually doing it well. People will rate the movie for its Atmos implementation. And across the board, everyone's like, the Disney movies, they haven't figured it out yet. They're just saying it's Atmos, but it's not very Atmos. And then that's neat. But then the other thing is like people say these movies are very good for Atmos. We mentioned a few weeks ago, The Quiet Place, I think is what it's called. Yeah. That's one that's good for it. I think the movie The Martian, like the Blu-ray has Atmos, but I don't think the Apple TV version does yet from iTunes. But maybe it does now. I've seen it and I own it, but I've not watched it yet with this in place. But it varies across the board of like what is actually Atmos compatible yet, and if it is Atmos, is it Atmos that you can notice, or is it Atmos on paper but you're not going to even appreciate it because it's so subtle, if not poorly placed, I guess. So that's
kind of like how sometimes they have quote unquote 3D movies that aren't really shot in 3D or anything, so you can kind of tell that it's so fake and.
They'll have like one 3D scene where something comes at you, but the rest of it is just like 3D for the sake of it.
Yeah, like they throw out one gimmick scene and that's it.
Yeah, so apparently that's happening in the Atmos world as well for Dolby Atmos.
Fantastic.
And that's, you know, the only thing that does for me is just like it makes it hard to recommend an Atmos system. You know, it's like, okay, you know, you don't really need it unless you really appreciate sound. And then even then you've got to go out and hunt for the films that work with it. The next thing is I am struggling here with Dolby Atmos on Apple TV because I've got an LG, I think it's a B7 OLED TV, and then the LG S39 soundbar. So it's like a very popular OLED television. So you get a really, really good picture with true black, like on the iPhone X, for example. And then that brand's soundbar for Atmos. So it's like, that's a pretty good combination. That's not some rare, you know, hobbyist thing. And to do this, you've got to have the inputs the right way. You can just hook everything up. I think what you're supposed to do is I've got like four HDMI ports, but one of them is HDMI ARC. And I think that one is like the more powerful port that has like more data or something. And you've got to have a certain HDMI cable. Apple sells them, you know, no problem. They cost more, but they do this thing. And so I've got two of those cables and you've got to run the Apple TV and the soundbar together through that one port on the Apple TV or on the actual TV. So I think it goes Apple TV to soundbar and then soundbar to TV itself using these fancier cables and that one HDMI ARC port, which aside here, I think it's HDMI 2. Why isn't it one if it's like the best one? But anyway, so HDMI 2 is the Apple TV and the soundbar goes through it. And when you watch an Atmos movie, the screen on the soundbar says Atmos at the beginning. And then, you know, so you know that's what you're getting. And then it goes back to like ARC for HDMI ARC. The problem is the really useful HDMI CEC feature on Apple TV where you can click a button on the Apple TV remote and the Apple TV turns on and the TV turns on if the TV supports HDMI CEC. And I've not had a problem with this feature ever, but with this Atmos setup, I've had to rewire the way things go, and now my TV turns on, and about 90% of the time, it goes to HDMI 4 when I click the Siri remote button. The TV turns on, goes to HDMI 4, and there's nothing on HDMI 4. I thought it was maybe the PS4. It's not. There's nothing there. It's an empty HDMI port, but now that I've got this set up, it goes to HDMI 4, and it drives my family crazy because then you got to get the actual TV remote, change the inputs, and go to HDMI 2, the good HDMI port that can do all the vision and Atmos stuff. And my family doesn't care. This is just only me that cares. It's the nerd stuff. And so they're like, what's wrong with the TV? And I just say, I don't know. I do know, though. I'm just not telling them.
And you're faking them out.
Yeah, I'm faking them out. And so then I say, I don't know, but just change the HDMI 2. So then we do. And a lot of times, Then you're on the Apple TV input in terms of the video stuff, but then you need to change the soundbar input, like flick through it and go, you know, get HDMI, you know, input throughput or whatever ARC again. And it's just way too many button clicks. Like something is not optimized here, And it's just because you've got to have this arrangement for Atmos. And, you know, like the logical thing here is to do is just abandon Atmos and be like, you know, you have this expensive soundbar, whatever. There aren't even that many movies with Atmos support. And the ones that do have it, like, it's rare that they're even that noticeable. That's what I should do. But on principle of, like, I've got the technology, it should work, I've not changed the wiring yet. And so we're dealing with this, like, input shuffle here. And a lot of times the easiest thing to do is just change the sound output as the TV speakers. So then we're not even using, like, the soundbar and subwoofer, and we're just using the TV speakers. And it's really crazy. It's maddening to me. And I'm curious, like, if anyone has the same problem, because I know it's the way that I've got the HDMI, you know, throughput working. And it's not just direct Apple TV to TV. It's that the soundbar's in the middle. But there aren't a lot of, like, OLED TVs out there. Like the LG makes them. I bet Samsung makes them. I think Sony's, like, getting into it. And then Atmos is, like, kind of like, you know, new stuff. It's not that common. And so this whole arrangement isn't. But I'm sure if you have, like, a dedicated receiver, you don't have any of these problems, maybe. But with this, you know, what I think would be a common and easy to recommend combination of TV and soundbar for Atmos, it's really, like, unusable.
It has a fatal flaw. Yeah.
Yeah.
CEC is infamously unreliable, I think. Like, it just, you can just have a normal receiver and it still muck up. Like, I don't know what the problem is here, but I wouldn't expect it's, like, specifically related to Atmos. It's just you've happened to change your setup to make the Atmos work and it's triggered it, if that makes sense.
Like, yeah.
I think HDMI CEC is just, unfortunately, not properly standardized across vendors and doesn't always work properly. And
yeah,
sometimes you can get stuck in the middle of it.
Yeah, I've heard the CEC is flaky, and if I ever had an issue with it before, I would just think, oh, CEC is flaky. And I know that's the reason, is that that's how this feature works, is CEC, and that is the fact that I've changed the wiring input that's what's flaking here. But man, I wonder what Apple's recommendation setup is, like, you know, with their TV of choices and you know, Atmos receiver or speaker of choices, because the one that I have isn't working in this situation. Maybe if Apple, like, made a TV and made some speakers, you know, then they could have their Apple TV box work with all this stuff. And it's like Apple TV, I think, is the only box that works with Vision and Atmos. So it's like, you know, they're special here. but they don't control the TV side or the speaker side, so it is what it is. If anyone has any feedback in this area, like for resolution, I'm curious.
Televisions are bad.
Yeah, back of hurt. Or if you're in the same boat, I'm curious too. If you're feeling my pain. Finally, I want to end on what we teased out last week, which was your thoughts on the whole Marzipan situation and the quality of Mac apps and Mac OS Mojave, specifically with porting iPad apps with very little modification onto the Mac. So let it out.
You'll probably be glad to know that I've slightly calmed down from my initial fury, not because I think anything that I blogged before anything is incorrect. It's just, you know, time heals all wounds. But I think Marzipan has noble goals, right? To make it easy to bring iOS apps to the Mac without throwing out all of the Mac paradigms. That is the current promise of the project, and it's clearly in the works. Apple didn't release it to developers. They just teased it at the end of the keynote, and they didn't even give it a proper name. Like, we call it Marzipan because that's what the code name is. If you actually, like, look in the source code, it says Marzipan as the project name in a few different places, but Apple officially just kind of calls it, like, iOS apps on the Mac, and they've said that it's in development and it will be released properly next year. So the real test of this stuff is next year. But what they did do is release a quartet of apps that use this technology on the Mac this month with Mojave without any public admission that these are somewhat flaky, beta, new, like, there's no news, stocks, voice memos, and home. are just apps on your system that if you're a normal user, you wouldn't have any idea that they were any different from how Apple presents them to you. News even gets put into your dock. So they want you to use these apps, right? But these apps, in their current state, are bad. Like, window resizing is terrible and laggy and slow. If you drag and drop a link to the desktop, it, like, hangs the entire window. Like, you get the beach ball just for dragging something to the desktop, and you can't click on anything else in the window for minutes at a time, or like, seconds at a time, which is ridiculous. And I think it's... I think any reasonably intelligent person can notice that these apps are not as good as, say, Mail or Safari or any of the other apps. Even Calculator, right? Like, I think you don't need to be a technically minded genius to realize that these apps are somehow worse than the other ones. They just don't work as well.
Like, something's off about them.
Something's off about them. Mm-hmm. And, like, the implementation detail of how they are made leaks out in when they are used. Like, you scroll and things were weird. You resize and things are weird. Like, you can get more fine-grained and start complaining about smaller stuff. Like, one of my complaints in the news app is that it says the word news, like, in, like, four different places. And that's kind of stupid, right? And my point is, if the news app had been made from the ground up as a Mac app, they wouldn't have done that because it's just redundant. But it ends up being in these different places because it's a port of the iPad app, and the iPad doesn't have a menu bar, so they put the news logo on it there, but then when you bring it to the Mac and there's a menu bar and a title bar on the window, like, that doesn't get adapted. These apps are basically their iPad versions in a window on the Mac, and, like, there's no multi-window. Like, one of the key defining features that separates iOS and the Mac is multiple windows. Like, you can have more than one window per app. But these Marzipan apps have no concept of that. And it gets even worse. Like, in Home, you go to open, like, a panel for one of your accessories. And because it doesn't support proper windows, it just brings up an iPad window, like a modal sheet in the middle of the screen. And it's the same thing that I complained about with Skype. Like, Skype does this exact same thing when you open audio settings. It brings up on top of the window as, like, this fake window, but you can just drag the top window around and it does the same thing. Well, now Apple ships that in its own apps, and they don't even apologize for it. Like, the news app is on the dock when you upgrade to Mojave, and it's just mediocre, borderline bad. Like, Home, you go into the... I think Home's the worst, the most treacherous, because I think it's the most complicated out of all the apps. Like, voice memos is, like, one screen. News is, like, a sidebar and then, like, a web view of stories. Home has, like, all these different accessories, and you can right-click and kind of weirdly open the settings menu for the accessories, but to get to the shortcut sliders, you have to double-click for some reason, just because it's kind of like a mechanical translation of the iPad app rather than, like, actually making a Mac app where... Because if you were actually making a Mac Home app, all of your accessories would not be, like, massive blocky tiles that are meant to be tapped on. Because you've got a mouse, it might be, like, a source list, and you could actually change brightness things without having to go into a detail menu. And then even if you set, like, a timer in the Home app, sometimes it comes up with, like, the iPad-style picker reels. You have to, like, scroll through with your mouse, even though they look... Like, they're just completely... Like, they just have iOS controls in a Mac window.
Yeah, I care a lot about HomeKit in the Home app, but I don't care so much about Apple News and voice memos and Stocks. I know that other people do, but they're just not apps that fit into what I use on iOS or the Mac. But the Home app, I spend a lot of time on. I put it on my dock, you know. And there's things like, I mean, some basic things, like if you're in dark mode, the apps don't really respond to that. The top bar can, the sidebars can, but there's not even a sidebar in the Home app. And if you go to the automation page, it's like light mode in your face, as if it was the web, but it's not. It's to the app itself. And it's like, you can see when there's a dark mode on iOS that this gets fixed, but there's not yet. And so this isn't fixed yet either. And there's so many things, like if you're playing around in the automation section of the Home app, you know, there are literally iOS toggles and the iOS, you know, like you said, date picker. You can't move this window around. And I found I've been running the beta all summer, and I've finally like had an experience where I was deleting an accessory from the Mac, and there's a custom window for that. It's like it's modal, but it looks like the Mac. Like it looks like it's a Mac window. So they've done a little bit of tweaking, but actually, like the Home app to me, all the other apps feel like the new versions of their iPad apps. The Home app isn't as good as the iOS apps are. Like navigation is almost the same, but using it, like you said, to open up the panel for one of the accessories, you've got to do, I don't know that there's like a fast way. I think it's just like a two-finger tap or a right click.
Yes, right click.
Yeah. To get the, so I do a two-finger tap, which is like secondary click on my trackpad. And then you get the option for show controls or settings. And
yeah, you right click to get a menu of two things.
Yeah.
Like think about any other app on the system. When do you right click and get a menu of two things?
Yeah.
Like, you'd have like eight different short, quick action things that you could do right there, but because they're just like mechanically translating every action that's in the iOS app without bringing anything to higher levels, you get two buttons. That's it.
And like, even so, like
one of them is what happens when you long press on the iPad, and one of them is what happens when you long press and then press the settings button. Like, mm-hmm. It's so like immature. Like, and basic. Like
I would be okay with this app if it was like long press and you get the popover that looks just like iOS. You know,
yeah.
Or if you've got a force touch trackpad, then you can, you know, deep press into it and then you can pop it over. Otherwise it's like click and hold and you gotta wait a little bit, but they didn't do that. The thing is they've got this house button in the top left corner that was added in one of the later versions of the beta. It wasn't initially there. It lets you switch between your homes and switch between your rooms and like a list, which is good, but that should be like an always visible sidebar. Like in the news app, you've got a sidebar of all your following sources and you can turn it on and off with a toggle. In the Home app, it's a pop down menu, and it can't be always present. I saw a really good mock up. I think you might have shared it with me. Someone shared it with you on Twitter of a Home app if it was like made for Mac from scratch. You know,
it wasn't even made for Mac. It was like just
adapted,
slightly more considered.
Yeah, slightly more considered.
Like actually, some non-zero amount of thought was put into it, and it was like 10 times better. And then my like point was, if someone actually gave it even more time, they could actually make a proper Mac app. Like, unfortunately, Apple hasn't released a HomeKit framework on the Mac, so there's no opportunity for third-party developers to make like a competing Home app. But I would love if there was, because then I think you'd see like the third-party developers would embarrass Apple 10 ways to Sunday compared to the Marzipan Home app. Like,
yeah, on iOS,
so much better job.
On iOS, HomeKit control was Siri was Apple's solution, and then the framework, and then developers can make apps like the very popular Home app. Before Apple had a Home app, there was a third-party Home app that still exists. It's really good. And it's like, okay, so or you could use – I mean, their real solution was like third-party manufacturer apps, you know, but once they made a Home app, it was much better. And it feels like the Voice Memos app, the News app, the Stocks app, they all got changes this year on the iPad, which reflects on the Mac, but the Home app hasn't been touched. It's like, is the person that made this even sold the company? Like, it's just not touched at all. And something so simple as changing the wallpaper in your home, in the home view of the Home app, like your first screen with all your favorite accessories. On the iOS app, it's a little bit tricky. Like it used to be like a compass icon that meant location and that had all your sections, which was like a poorly planned thing. And they changed it, I think, to a house, and just so it doesn't look like a current location button. But you go there and you get all your settings. And on the Mac, there's no button for that. It's just not there. And you've got to go to the menu bar and go to edit and then go to edit home. And then you get that panel. And it looks like iOS. It's why they've hidden it, I guess. But it's like all these things that you can do, like update your HomePod, manage notifications, manage like who has access to home, you know, your HomeKit stuff, name your home, see your hubs, like all that is in this like hidden section. Even like deleting your home, like if you want to scratch it, you know, from your Mac, it's really hidden. But this is where they put the wallpaper picker, and like it's super hidden. And the other thing, the other way to do it that feels a little bit more Mac friendly is like drag and drop an image. And I think it works on Rooms, but not the main screen. I think the main screen, you've got to go to that like hidden menu bar feature, you know, area. So it's just really weird. And the thing that bothers me the most about the Home app and the Mac, you know, this Marzipan approach is that if I had envisioned a home up on the Mac. The benefits of it would be keyboard and mouse control. Like, you can mass select objects and like move them in groups to different rooms and like order them, you know, like drag and drop a selector over two light bulbs, right click it, and then create a group out of those two things. It's kind of hard to do on iOS because there's no concept of like drag and drop a selector with your mouse, but on the Mac there is. So it could be like that where it, you know, if you're doing heavy lifting stuff like setting up your home from scratch, or you moved and you've got to like reproduce all this stuff, but you want it in different rooms, on the Mac it could be like the efficient way to do it. Whereas like on iOS it's different, but it's portable, so it's access. And they've not done that.
It'd be like different UI for different platforms.
Yeah, they've not done that. And,
like,
and
I think the basic example, right, is the iOS. You have limited screen room space, and you have to make things big to be touchable. So, if you're in a room with two lights, you can't change the brightness of those lights until you activate them, right? Like, you have to press on them.
Mm-hmm.
On the Mac, you could have the sliders just on the screen the whole time, like. You don't need these like modal contexts to do this stuff because you have a Mac, you have a mouse cursor that is much more precise.
You could
like,
shift and click
things on screen at once.
You could shift and click an accessory and then go to like down the list, shift click, and everything in between would be selected. Or you could command click one, command click another way over here, and both would be selected. Like, those are Mac things, you know. There could be keyboard shortcuts for like rooms, you know, like command shift one, command shift two, like even for tabs. And like,
and
I don't
you could
know
have
that
like a sidebar of your favorites, and you could drag the accessories into the sidebar. Like,
yeah,
so much potential.
Like right now, you
and
can
they
do.
Just didn't bother doing any of it.
Yeah, they do command. They can do command one, command two, and command three to change between the three tabs. But you can't do that for rooms. It's like you've got to swipe, which is not super, you know, intuitive.
The swiping doesn't even work properly. Like, it lags out, and you have to swipe like three times to move one page. Sometimes, like
a lot of times, I'll launch the home app from scratch, and it's like just black for a while until it loads in. And my hope for the home app, like even if it looked just like the iPad version, was that. My iPad isn't new. It's the first version of the Pro, and I had, you know, the review unit of the 2018 iPad Pro. And I was like, okay, does this app just like blow the iPad version out of the water in performance? And the answer is no. Like, it doesn't matter how fast the processor is. Like, it's how it's implemented.
Like,
it's,
you can't even resize the window and it'd be smooth.
Like, yeah, like it's not responsive to your processor power or like your GPU. It's that the app itself, like on the best hardware, is not done well. You know,
they're at most beta, probably more realistically like alpha versions.
Mm-hmm.
And just so I'm not like whining the whole time, I want to give an alternative thing that they could have done. Like, there was no reason why Apple had to ship four apps on this technology this year. I think it'd have been better. They could have done none at all and just announced it at WWDC and said it's coming next year. I think it'd be better if they'd have done one, maybe two, and like spent the extra time over focusing down to like do some more Mac-specific customizations and then ship those apps in the App Store so you could download them if you want them, but they're not like pre-installed. So at least there's this like admission that, yeah, they're not like, they're not up to the normal Apple standards of quality just yet. Because like, I think, especially when you put something in the dock, which is what the news app does, you're like saying this is the future of the Mac. This is like Mac quality standards, right? And it's just a lie. Like
the Mac App Store approach would be neat because it's kind of like Shortcuts. How Shortcuts is in the App Store on iOS. It's like, it's kind of for power users, you know? You can pre-install it, but like if you put it in the App Store, you got to go and find it. And if these were in the Mac App Store, you'd need to know to go look for them for the most part. Like, you could stumble upon them, but then they'd have explainer text around them, like, you know, try out these apps ahead of time if they intend to make them better. But they wouldn't be built in. And the other thing is, like, maybe you could even update them faster than like through a Mac OS update, like even a point update. Like, Apple has control over when that happens. But it would be neat to see an update in the Mac App Store for the home app. And like, it's like a tweak without having a whole Mac OS point version. Because as we discussed earlier with the charging fix on iOS, like, Apple might be holding that back artificially, like it's ready to go, but they're waiting for this other big update to come out to do it. You know, I think that happens on the Mac too. Whereas if they were on the Mac App Store, you could have, 1.0.2 of the home app, you know, and it's like,
yeah,
some
and they could
subtle
be in
change.
Like a rolling beta for a year.
Mm-hmm. That'd be neat.
Like, I don't understand why Apple has been on this bandwagon of we don't want to merge the operating systems. We want to let each operating system be the best it can be. We don't like lowest common denominator software. You know, we're doing great experiences here, great experiences here. Maybe some shared core stuff. Like, the Photos app is shared core, but you like properly unique user interfaces of both platforms. Like, they are of the same genetic formation. Like, they look similar-ish, but they're still Mac-specific stuff, and there's iPad-specific stuff, and there's iPhone-specific stuff. And I don't understand, like, even at WWDC, Craig had that massive slide where it's like, are we merging iOS and the Mac? No. But then they do this, which is essentially just putting iOS apps on the Mac and then not worrying about it. Like,
you know,
and I don't care. Like, yes, it's not finished, but it concerns me that this is something they would do at all. Like, full stop.
It's more like
imagine we had no rumors of the Marzipan framework stuff.
Yeah.
We had no people digging the code. Apple didn't say they were working on a third-party framework. Imagine they just shipped these four apps as they are. People go nuts. And something that's really important is that none of these apps are mission-critical and that none of them existed before. And apart from maybe Home, none of them are like most of the apps that you just put in the rubbish folder on your phone or whatever. Like, they're rarely used. Imagine if Apple had actually changed Mail to be the iPad Mail as a Marzipan app. Like, people would be flipping out. It would just be unacceptable. And for me, the Home app is a really, really nice app on the iPhone and the iPad. I actually really like it. And I was hoping they'd put their heads together and eventually do a Mac app that was really, really good. And they just haven't. And I'm concerned that this is how the Home app will be this year, next year, and the year after that. Like, the Marzipan system might get better, but these apps might be considered done. Like, there's nothing to tell me otherwise, apart from common sense that they aren't very good. Like, I don't think it's unfair to be concerned and annoyed about this stuff. Like, these apps could be as they are for years to come. And like, I think the Home app deserves better. All of the apps deserve better. And Apple's put their seal of quality on it at some point to ship them at all. Like, I think it's just sad. And the idea of like, oh, we don't want to merge these platforms together, we want both to be great in different ways, like, that just doesn't hold up to me when you do this stuff. Like, I didn't mind the Mac was behind, it's get stuff more slowly because we take our time and we do it for the platform. Like, I'm not worried about like checking off every feature going down. I don't mind being slow, right? If they'd have just done the news app this year as like an actual Mac app and just done that, you know, I'd have probably said, oh, it sucks, we can't do HomeKit on the Mac yet, but the news app's pretty nice, right? But instead it's like, oh, now we're checking off bullet points of features, but they're all kind of bad. I think they should have done one app this year in this new formation, actually spent more time in it, and then maybe done the HomeKit stuff on the Mac just inside Siri. So at least you can do HomeKit on the Mac. But don't release these apps that are just not up to normal Mac standards or not up to Apple standards at all, full stop. Like, that's what I don't like.
Yeah, I wonder if part of it is like how it's framed. And right now it's all about Apple because it is the preview and they're not letting other people do this. But that the goal really is to have a better app like ecosystem on the Mac, whereas the trend right now is, you know, apps are going away or they're just not on the Mac or they're not updated as quickly, you know. But that Apple should have, you know, further emphasize, aside from the quality of these Mac apps, like, this is for you developers and Mac users who really like your iPhone and iPad apps but don't have them on the Mac, and then say, like, we're you know, dog fooding this and doing it with our own. I mean and that was implied and like kind of said, but it wasn't emphasized, but there is a part of this is like the reaction to the quality of this project is minimal right now. Like, it's very easy to defend people or you know, debate people that are critical of it because it isn't replacing an app that existed. It's putting something on there that didn't exist before. So you can easily say it's function that wasn't there before. You know, don't worry about the rest. It'll get better. But if we see an app that used to be good get replaced and become subpar, even if it has a different set of features, like if suddenly messages becomes way worse than it already is, but then it can send balloons, like, then we can really debate, you know, the quality of this. But then it's going to be a whole...
Messages actually might be the only app that might benefit from just becoming a straight Marzipan port, because
yeah.
Messages on Mac is pretty bad.
Yeah, but it's going to be complicated no matter what, because like there are... It isn't like there are zero Mac apps from developers. There are really good Mac apps. And I do think that there's an argument to be had that like some developers that do custom Mac apps now might be better off if they do, you know, the Marzipan style of like sharing iPad code on the Mac, even if it means some trade-offs, like that it's just... You got to decide for yourself on each one. But I think the fact is, like, the customer-facing part of all this with these four apps, you know, you've got to watch WWDC and read the rumors and news to have all the context. But if you just look at it as, like, a customer using the computer and, like, you just notice that these are flakier than the other apps, then they've not communicated that at all. It's just like, we have new apps in the Mac, and they've not... you know, properly presented it. I love the Mac App Store idea. Then you've got all this text of like just describing it in context of what's happening here. You know, opt
into
this. Put a
beta label on it. Just have news beta.
Yeah, opt into this. You know, updates more frequently than a big point update or the next year update. By the way, home is 3.0 because it's 3.0 on iOS, I guess. It doesn't feel like a 3.0 though, but...
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. It's a technical achievement for them to even do this, but that doesn't make it... That doesn't excuse them doing it. Like, they need to be a higher quality bar than what they are. And I'm not 100% convinced that they would do that. Like, maybe in years past I would have had more faith, but recently we've seen stuff like where big apps on the Apple Watch Series 4 just have, like, clip text, and it's like, is you going to fix that anytime soon? Maybe, maybe not. Like, WatchOS 5.1 doesn't fix it at the moment.
Right.
Will WatchOS 5.2 fix it? Or is it going to be WatchOS 6? Or is it going to be ever? Like, and this is your, like, statement. You brought up four apps to kind of back up this, we are doing this great new thing, and all four of them are bad in a million different ways. Mm-hmm. And, like, I struggle. Like, this is one of the most concerning things. I think Apple's, like, the fact that they ship these without any admission of them being bad. As a customer, like,
yeah,
if all Mac apps were like this, the Mac would be terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah, I think the test for you will be next year. If it doesn't improve, like, do you make the decision to ship apps that you have on iOS on the Mac too? So we'll see what happens with that next year. I want to end on a lighter note, a happier note, and just say I'm really excited about, you know, the prospect of new iPads coming out this month. It's like, yes. We had a lot of rumors, and then the iPhone event happened and the watch came out and all that stuff. So it's like, it's not as bubbling up at the top right now, but it feels like it's happening and then it's going to be this month. And so I just want to say I'm looking forward to that. I feel like, you know, the event, I did a story earlier this week about like when was last year's or the last October event. It was late in the month. You know, so like they're thinking now it could be like mid October or late October. But no matter when it is, like, it's pretty soon if there is second event.
The invites can't be too far away.
Exactly. So I'm hyped about that. I've been taking my iPad, which is cracked on the center, of just like a wear crack that got worse. I've got a screen protector over it to like use without cutting myself. And I've been like just watching movies on it at the gym while I'm running. And I just every time I do that, I'm thinking about, I can't wait until this is like edge to edge, you know. And I wasn't so sure I was going to buy a new iPad this year, but of course I am. I'm thinking I'll go with the 12.9-inch one. And if it's really like slim bezel, you know, it'll be so much smaller. So I'm hyped about that. Looking forward to invites going out and like confirming all of this as like actually an event. But I'm excited about it. I just wanted to mention that I'm excited about iPads. So.
Yeah, I think the new iPads will be really cool.
Yeah, yeah. Plus some Mac stuff in there too. But that's another story. All right, that's the Happy Hour Podcast for this week. If you enjoyed the show, let us know. We're on Twitter. I'm at Apollo Zach Benjamin. You are?
BZA Mayo.
And you can give us feedback at happyhour@95mac.com. I apologize for last week. I released an episode that I had edited incorrectly in some way, where Benjamin's audio was clipping much hotter than my audio was. And that was my fault. And then we're always working to improve audio. So any feedback is greatly appreciated there. There was a second version that went out, but unfortunately all the podcast apps download pretty quickly usually. So I know a lot of people we heard from had that first version. So hopefully no issues this week. And with that being said, we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.